Stellacast Episode 3, this one's for the Breadheads. Well, hello there, fellow Breadheads. Jacob Byrne here, StellaCulinary.com, with Stellacast, answering your culinary questions. Talking food, all that fun stuff. So I had quite a few questions popping up on the Stella Culinary Forum with bread, which is a really big part of what we do at Stella Culinary, just kind of by default. I'm a big fan of bread, big breadhead. A lot of content on, especially sourdough. So if you want to get into that, Stella Culinary is the place for you to be. I would start with our series, our podcast series, the Stella Culinary School podcast. Starting off, I believe, at episode 18. And we do a five-part series on bread. And it goes pretty in-depth, all the way from the basics, which we cover in 18 and 19, all the way up into some really advanced sourdough bread baking and beyond. And as a little sneak peek, as I was talking about in the last episode of Stellacast, I'm just going to say it like that all the time because I know it really annoys people. As I was talking about that in the last episode, pizza. We just finished shooting a bunch of video on pizza. So we actually are going to finish our bread lecture series in the Stella Culinary School podcast with a podcast episode on pizza, which is something I've been promising for a very long time now. And I intend to make good on that promise, even though it has taken a while. So we will give you a full expert course in pizza making with videos to back it up. And the videos that we have shot and the recipes we have tested thus far are Sicilian, New York, Chicago, and of course, Neapolitan from our wood fire oven. So we're going to start off with a sourdough baguette thread going between a couple of my sourdough disciples, not really, but a couple of breadheads on the Stella Culinary Forum. Dave Mott, who is a longtime forum member and a real legit baker. You might see him pop up too on the Fresh Loaf Forum, which is a forum specifically dedicated to bread baking, also known as TFL. So Dave Mott, he posts on the Stella Culinary Forum and also on the Fresh Loaf Forum. The guy's a real awesome baker. And he's shown off some pictures of his sourdough baguettes that he has been working on. But he forgot to score them, which is funny. I've done that before. It really pisses me off. And if the whole, and this is actually a really good example of why scoring bread is important, because when you go through and you form bread, there's just going to be some natural weaknesses in that formed piece of dough. So what scoring does is it tells the bread, hey, expand here. So you're basically creating weaknesses in the loaf by slicing the loaves in strategically placed spots. And you're saying to the loaf, hey, when you expand in the oven, when you have that beautiful oven spring, I want you to rupture and expand here, which allows the dough to expand more evenly and gives you a better shape and a cool-looking design. So he's working on his baguettes along with Wartface, and they're kind of going back and forth on creating the sourdough baguettes. Now, one thing that I do say when I jump in the forum and I discuss these sourdough baguettes is and we talked about this in the last episode. Remember when we were talking about the alkaline brine, so placing the baking soda in your brine to increase alkalinity, which gives you better flavor and better smell. Well, what we were talking about too is it leads to easier browning, and this has to do with the Maillard reaction. So when you raise the pH in something, it browns more easily. Now, when you drop the pH in something, it's harder for that item to brown. So you need a higher temperature for the Maillard reaction to occur. So I was looking at Wartface's sourdough baguettes, his first time through, and He's baking these on his barbecue grill, which is actually pretty cool. And they look beautiful. My only issue with them is they're a little blonde on the outside. The interior looks gorgeous, but they're a little blonde on the outside. And the reason why this occurs is because he was baking them at the normal temperature at which you would bake baguettes. But because he's creating a sourdough baguette, he actually needs to raise the baking temperature. And when we bake these at the restaurant, I use our wood fire oven, so we will fire up the wood fire early on in the morning. A lot of times we'll actually have some wood in the wood fire drying out. And then the night before we leave for the evening, we'll just start a nice big fire in the oven and let it burn down to coals. And the following day, we get in the morning, spread the hot coals over the deck of the oven, and that saturates the deck with heat. After the coals die down, we then sweep the coals out of the oven and allow the temperature of the oven, which at that point is usually about 800 degrees Fahrenheit, we allow it to slowly drop down in temperature. And this creates a really even heat and a surface, or the deck of our oven or the floor of our oven is absolutely charged with heat, which gives us great oven spring. Now, when baking our sourdough baguettes, I'll let the oven drop, or the temperature of the deck of the oven drop, to about 515 to 525 degrees Fahrenheit, which is really hot for your normal bread baking. But this is because we're using a sourdough starter. And then I'll bake the baguettes for about 18 minutes. And this gives me a really hard crust and a beautiful dark golden brown that I like. And especially when I'm doing like artisan style sourdough breads in my wood fire oven, I like a really dark crust, almost in certain areas flirting with burnt. And you have this gradient sort of coloring of brownness on your sourdough loaves that go from a mid-tone golden brown all the way up to really, really dark brown, which is almost, you know, a black burnt. And in my opinion, this gives you the best complexity of flavor with your crust. But also, too, because I'm normally using a higher hydration dough for my sourdoughs, I want to make sure that I'm driving all of that moisture out of that crust and really setting it firm. So then that way, when the bread cools off and I slice into it, I maintain the integrity of that crisp, crackly crust. A lot of the times what happens is if you cook at too low of a temperature, you don't drive enough moisture out of the crust. And when it comes out of the hot oven, the crust seems crisp. But then the interior moisture of your bread, as that crust cools, will migrate outward to that hard crust and soften it again. Which, if you like a soft crust, is fine. And that's going to be your approach. But if you want that hard, crackly crust, that baguettes are quite frankly known for, then you need that higher temperature, especially when baking with sourdough. Now, in the same thread, go further down. So it's just an interesting thread to read back and forth. There's some nice pictures in there. So we're basically talking sourdough baguettes. Then T. Morrison pops in with a question. And he says, Chef, really enjoying the site. I'm getting ready to put my sourdough boule in the Dutch oven for baking. I've always just cooked on a cooking sheet or a cookie sheet, but with my last boule, it stuck pretty badly to the sheet. I had to put semolina on top of the sheet. Is there anything I should do to prepare the Dutch oven? I've read on other sites to generously flour the bottom of the dough. So you think this would prevent sticking? Thanks again. So the reason why you cook in a Dutch oven, if people are new to this concept, is you'll preheat your oven with a Dutch oven and a lid inside to heat it up. And what will happen is, so when you're creating a artisan-style boule, as we demonstrate in our sourdough bread video, so just go to stellacolinary.com/SB. That's our bread baking index. SB stands for Stella Bread. So stellacolinary.com/SB. In our bread baking video index, you'll see our basic boule video. And in that, I demonstrate how to take your boule, which is basically it's a round piece of dough, and bake it in a cast iron Dutch oven. And when you bake it for the first, say, 15 to 20 minutes with the lid on, it creates a moist steam environment, which gives you a superior dough expansion, or what you call oven spring. So you get a nice expansion of your loaf as it bakes in that initial, you know, 10 minutes. But that steam will also condense on the crust, giving you a little bit of a thinner crust and giving that beautiful crackly crust that, you know, artisan bread is known for, especially sourdoughs and baguettes. So that's why we would bake in a Dutch oven. As far as keeping it from sticking, normally if you heat the oven, or excuse me, if you heat the Dutch oven enough, so if you charge that Dutch oven with enough heat, it's not, your bread isn't going to stick to it. Now, I will always, you know, flour the underside of my boule pretty generously, but that's just more for exterior texture. If you're working with a really wet dough, then you could have some issues with it sticking. But really, when sticking does occur, it's because the Dutch oven wasn't preheated enough. T. Morrison then follows up. He says, sourdough boule is out and cooled. Chef, it did release fantastically. Scoring not so great. I think I was a little afraid putting my hand in the hot Dutch oven. Made only half the recipe. What do you think of the crumb? Is this close to the desired effect? Thanks for any comments. Sorry, can't figure out how to add a picture. No worry, T. Morrison. I will add a picture to the forum for you. But T. Morrison did email me a picture of the crumb, which let me pull it up here and double check. So looking at the crumb of your bread looks great. And I will post this in the forum. It looks like you came out with a really tasty piece of bread there, especially sourdough, which is a lot more difficult than when you're using commercial yeast. The one comment that I will make is it looks like the bread was probably overproofed, and you could best know this by when you place the bread, or when you place the boule into your Dutch oven and scored it, did you notice it deflate at all? And the reason why I'm looking at that cross section, and from the photo, the bread isn't as tall as it should be. So this could happen from a few things. First, it could happen just from poor forming, which is a practice thing, but it doesn't really seem like it's formed poorly just looking at it from the photo. But if you notice in our video, we do go through and do some tension pulls where we are pulling that boule towards us and rotating it and tightening the gluten structure on the top of the dough. And this is going to create the proper tension that allows for a good oven spring and also during proofing. So just double check that you're doing the tension pulls properly as demonstrated in the video. Now, if this was underproofed, then your crumb would look more dense and you would see like pockets of dense air bubbles kind of packed together, and then pockets of larger air bubbles. But your crumb looks pretty even here, and the air bubbles are nice and evenly dispersed throughout the crumb. However, because of the height of your dough and because your crumb does look nice and airy, I'm thinking that your dough was overproofed slightly. So what this what happens when you overproof dough is the carbon dioxide gas that's created by the yeast and the lactobacilli bacteria in your sourdough starter. It expands that dough outwards during proofing, pressing the dough past the extent of the gluten structure. And then when you apply any sort of pressure to that dough, just as simply as like flipping it out into your Dutch oven or scoring it, that gluten structure is going to collapse back inwards because it's pretty much exhausted at that point. Looking at your picture, looks like it occurred. So what you want to look at for next time, and just remember back when you were making this, you know, when you placed this into your Dutch oven, when you scored it, did you see the dough deflate slightly when you did that? And if it did deflate slightly when you placed it in the Dutch oven and scored it, then you know that it was it was overproofed. So next time what you want to be looking for is during the proofing process, you want to look for about a 1.5x or a 1.5 times increase in volume. Now, in normal bread baking, you would be looking for a 2x increase in volume. But with sourdough bread, the acidity of the sourdough will weaken the gluten structure to the extent of, if you go to a 2x volume rise, so you're looking for, so if you during the proofing process, if your dough proofs to 2 times its original volume after being formed, a lot of the times that's a little bit too much. And then when you go to score the bread or turn the bread out into your, you know, onto your baking peel or into your Dutch oven, you're going to see it collapse inward slightly. So look for a 1.5 raise in volume or increase in volume during the proofing, and then bake at that when it's achieved that volume. But also, too, if you press your finger into the dough slightly during proofing, when it's at the perfect time to bake, it should very gently spring back at you and fill that indentation back up with gas. Now, if it just kind of sits there and your indentation, if your fingerprint just stays in the dough, then you know that it's underproofed. But if you get to a point where you press it in and you can actually kind of see that area of the dough collapse slightly when you are pressing your finger into it, then you know it's overproofed. So just kind of use the finger test and look for it to slowly spring back at you. Outside of that, yeah, you know, sticking your hand into a hot Dutch oven to score it can be quite daunting, especially if you're not used to touching things that are 500 degrees Fahrenheit and burning yourself. I have burns all up and down my wrist because it's just, you get used to them after a while. You know, it's never an enjoyable experience, you know, touching something hot and burning yourself, but it's kind of just part of the job when you work in a kitchen professionally. You get used to getting burns. So it doesn't overly concern me, and I have burnt myself using the Dutch oven method just by sticking my arm in there and, you know, slicing the top of the boule, and I touch the edge of the cast iron with my wrist or my forearm, and I get a quick little burn. Now, what you can do is they are more expensive than a Dutch oven, but you can buy what's called a cloche, and they're made specifically for baking bread in your home oven. And what it looks like is it's like a round ceramic disc that has a lid that fits on top. And it's a lot easier to maneuver around the bread without burning yourself. So you would just take the bread, you would put it onto that preheated ceramic disc, place the preheated lid right on top using an oven mitt or a towel, and then pop it back into your oven. And you should be good to go. But outside of that, I mean, your bread looks beautiful. The crumb looks beautiful. Really, the only thing that I can see that's possibly wrong with it is it was underproofed. Now, next up, we have Gadzik asking about Teresa Greenway's double hydration technique / theory when it comes to baking sourdough bread. So Gadzik says, before I have found the site, I always thought that long kneading develops gluten, which is crucial for keeping the gas bubbles in the bread. Chef Jacob says it is better to handle the dough as little as possible, and you need the high hydration dough, and it works. The extreme example is the no-knead bread technique that gives the best results in my case. This fact seems a bit weird to me. Now, Teresa Greenway, the great baker, says that actually low hydration helps you develop the gluten network better. So she starts with low and gradually adds more water with each stretch and fold. Her loaves are always spectacular, so there must be a bit of truth. To sum it up, I am confused. The gluten development is my main concern since I don't have the access to real bread flour here in Poland. And I really want to master it as much as possible. What do you think of the double hydration theory? If it works, please explain to me why. So I went through and I watched her entire series on that. Gadzik does post the first YouTube video in that series. And so Teresa Greenway is of Northwest Sourdough, and she has some pretty good videos on her YouTube channel. And so what she does is she mixes her dough and allows it to autolyse at a lower hydration. So in her video, she's mixing the water with the flour and her hydration in her initial mix is 60%, which is fairly low. It's a stiff dough that's hard to work. She allows it to auto-lease for about 2 hours before she adds the salt in. So her initial mix is 60% hydration, including her sourdough starter, plus her flour, auto-lease for 2 hours, and then adds in her salt. And then she adds in another 100 grams of water on top of that, and then incorporates that water over time by doing a stretch and fold, coming back, I think, like an hour later, doing another stretch and fold, coming back an hour later, until the water's fully incorporated and it raises up to 68% hydration. Now, in her video, she says the reason why she does this is because it allows you to have a higher hydration dough that's easier to work without that dough, quote-unquote, falling apart on you. Now, my thing is so it looks – so the her gluten structure looks great in the video. I've never used the double hydration step. I do work quite a bit with higher hydration doughs. And the other people that I know that work with higher hydration doughs, I've never seen them use the double hydration step. So I'm not saying it doesn't work, but also to her comment of it keeps the gluten structure, or excuse me, it allows you to have a higher hydration dough without the gluten falling apart or without the dough itself falling apart, basically making it easier to handle. To me, 68% hydration isn't even that high of a hydration. That's about that's a pretty standard hydration. And the end result that she achieves as far as gluten structure and interior crumb and the bread holding together during forming and proofing doesn't look any different than when I make a 68% hydration sourdough loaf without using the double hydration step. Now, for this, for me to really give you a real answer, I'd have to test both side by side. And the way that I would test this is I would do one control. So I'd keep everything else the same, and I would basically just mix, one batch of bread straight at 68% hydration, and then mix another batch of bread at 60% hydration, and then later bring it up to 68% hydration by adding the extra water during the stretch and folds. Then form them side by side and bake them side by side, then take detailed notes. In my opinion, though, making a 68% hydration dough is pretty straightforward. Now, her bread comes out beautiful. She seems to know what she's talking about. She doesn't really give much in the way of science or a reference as to why the double hydration works, except anecdotally that it works for her. So I'm not questioning that. It could work. I'm not that familiar with the technique. I don't understand the science behind the technique. Visually looking at her bread, it doesn't look that much different than the bread I make if I were to make a 68% hydration sourdough bowl. So I'm not convinced. Again, I'm not saying that it doesn't work. I just don't have, I haven't done the testing on my end, and I haven't been able to look at any scientific research that would prove it either correct or incorrect. So as far as Gadzik, being in Poland, she uses bread flour in her formulation. So she has her theories about the double step hydration, but one thing will hold true regardless. If you're not able to find yourself some good bread flour, you're going to always have an issue creating sourdough breads. That's just, it is what it is. So you're going to have to do some research and try and figure out a way to get yourself some high protein, high gluten bread flour, especially if you want to start working with sourdoughs. I know that's not the advice that you want to hear, but you're going to have issues with your bread always if you don't figure out where to get some bread flour. Specifically if you're going to use sourdough, because you need a higher gluten structure a higher gluten content for sourdough, because when you drop the pH in bread, which sourdough does because sourdough is acidic, hence why we call it sourdough, when you drop the pH in that bread, it will weaken the gluten structure in your bread. So this is why when you're creating sourdough breads with like a long delayed fermentation, you're allowing more acidic acid, which is what causes sourdough to be sour, build up in your bread. You get that nice sour flavor, but you can also have issues with your structure. The bread can be more dense. It will collapse on itself. And that all has to do with the gluten structure being weaken from acidity. So you're going to need to have red flour that has about 13.5% protein content in it. So yeah, thanks for the question. I would have to do some more research and side-by-side testing on my end, but it is definitely a interesting theory. And if you look at the Northwest, I believe it, let me double check, make sure I'm giving them proper credit here. Sorry, that was a commercial. So this, yeah, so username is Northwest Sourdough on YouTube. And they have some really nice videos. So go through and watch their videos and copy some of their technique. You know, I mean, you can't go wrong. As far as the double hydration step, I'm not convinced, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't work. I will never make up my mind on something until I can scientifically prove it wrong, or I've done enough testing to realize that it either works, doesn't work, or doesn't make a difference. Now, my next question comes from Mao, who sent me a PM, but we're talking bread, and he or she is asking about soy lecithin in powder form, and says, I'm a professional baker. I would like to know if it is possible to convert the normal soy lecithin to the powder form so I can make a homogeneous premix blend for my pan bread and my French baguettes. Yeah, so it sounds like Mao is using a liquid lecithin. So lecithin is an emulsifier that comes from eggs, and you can find lecithin in a lot of health food stores. You can find it online, and it can come in a liquid or a powder form. So Mao is trying to do a premix blend of the bread flours with the lecithin, and it sounds like he or she is just using liquid lecithin at this point. So I would recommend buying powdered lecithin online. And again, Amazon.com is a great place to buy lecithin, especially if you live in the United States, which it doesn't sound like you do. I think it does, because you say, can you recommend an address to buy lecithin and tapioca maltodextrin in the USA. Yeah, so both, you know, so Amazon.com, you know, will sell lecithin and tapioca maltodextrin. That's where we get our lecithin and tapioca maltodextrin. As far as why you want to use tapioca maltodextrin in your bread, or maybe you're just, you know, you're asking where to get it, it's not really clear. I've never used tapioca maltodextrin in my bread. The reason why you would use tapioca maltodextrin, we use it for drying out fats, so that's how you make like powdered olive oil or powdered peanut butter, or what we call dehydrated peanut butter that we'll then roll our chocolate ganache truffles in. So tapioca maltodextrin is a very lightweight bulking agent that absorbs fat, and it has a neutral flavor. So you can mix the maltodextrin with olive oil, turning it into a powder, because the maltodextrin is absorbing the fat, but then the maltodextrin melts almost immediately, or dissolves almost immediately, when it comes into contact with moisture. So, and just that little bit of like saliva on your palate is enough moisture for the maltodextrin to dissolve. So it gives you this sensation of when you place the dehydrated olive oil in your mouth, it gives you the sensation of it rehydrating back into olive oil, right? Which is kind of a cool effect. So this isn't to be confused with tapioca starch, which is commonly used as a thickening agent, or, you know, we'll use it in our frying dredges sometimes too. So tapioca starch is different from tapioca maltodextrin, just so you know. Now, one of the applications that you could use, so it sounds like you're trying to create a pre-mix with your flours. So if you're creating bread that has fats in them and you want to create a pre-mix for that, then you can take the amount of fat that you would normally use in your bread flour mixture or in your bread recipe. You can dehydrate that fat by mixing with tapioca maltodextrin and then mix that back into your flour. So this would be applicable if you're, say, using, so say you're creating some sort of rich dough bread mixture that you want to just, you know, give people a pack of, you know, pre-mixed flour And all they have to do later on is add water to create, say, a brioche dough recipe. This could theoretically be accomplished by taking your eggs and your butter in that brioche dough recipe, dehydrating the water out, and then taking that fat and mixing it with tapioca maltodextrin to dehydrate it, which would allow you to then blend it with your flour. Now, the reason why you would add lecithin to a bread dough recipe, and normally you would add it at about a quarter percent to 1% based upon the baker's percentage, so based upon the weight of your flour. And if you go to celicolonia.com/SB, we have a whole video on the baker's percentage, which will explain that in more detail to you. But you would add, you know, 0.25%, so a quarter percent to 1% lecithin by weight of the flour. And lecithin is an emulsifier, so it's nice to be used in recipes that contain a little bit of fat, because it will bind that fat with the water in that bread dough and allow it to trap more gas. So when you have the water and the fat emulsified together in your bread dough, it's going to trap more gas, which allows it to expand better. So you get a fuller rise during the proofing process, and also a better oven spring or expansion, yielding a more airy loaf, which is what you want in your bread. Also, too, it will soften the crumb because, again, the fat is emulsified into the crumb. It's not separate from the crumb. So it can act as a softening agent as well. Now, our final question comes from Wartface. And Wartface sent me a picture showing off his boule that he made. And he says, "Chef Jacob, a while ago, I made a loaf of bread using 600 grams flour, 400 grams water." So if you want to figure out the percentage, it'd be 400 grams water divided by 600 grams flour equals a 66% hydration on the dough, which is not a low hydration, but it's also not considered a high hydration dough. 12 grams salt, 200 grams of starter as part of the formula. So you're getting a extra 100 grams of water. So we're probably a little bit closer to 68% hydration. Now he says, "I got really big holes in the crumb with this loaf. My question is why? What caused these large holes? Was it the air pockets created by the slap and folds, which is one of the techniques that we use for kneading dough? Was it too much active starter? Was it overproofing? I don't need to know. Just want to know the cause." Okay, so a lot of times the big holes in your dough will be caused by a higher hydration and less handling. So the more you handle the dough, the more you knead the dough, the more cohesive the dough will become, meaning the tighter the crumb you'll have. The less you knead the dough, so if you're doing a lot of stretch and folds to develop the structure and you're using a higher hydration, then the larger holes you will have and the more irregular shaped crumb you will have. Now, this is desirable in a lot of artisan-style breads where they want to have that open structure, open irregular crumb. But you can take it too far. And in the pictures that you sent me, Wartface, it looks like you have some really large air pockets in your dough. Now, the air pockets that I'm looking at from the picture that you sent me are commonly formed by not degassing the dough completely or thoroughly enough between bulk fermentation and proofing. So after you mix your sourdough starter and your flour and your water together, and then you knead it, you go into bulk fermentation, where you're taking that whole mass of dough and you are fermenting it, allowing the yeast and the lactobacillus bacteria to go in there and start to invigorate themselves and raise your bread dough during that bulk fermentation. So you have a bunch of gas built up. Now, when it comes time to form the dough, you take the dough out, you put it on your work surface, and you degas it slightly. Now, you don't want to be too rough. You don't really want to punch down the dough, but you will notice that as you're degassing the dough on your work surface, there will be larger pockets of air. And these larger pockets of air, if they're not degassed, then you just basically, to degas them, you squeeze those pockets of air. They will then turn into really large air pockets in your formed loaf. So after the bulk fermentation is when you are cutting the dough into its final shape, where you're forming it, just make sure you're pressing out the larger air pockets in that dough, squeezing out those air holes before you form the final loaf and then proof. And if you do that, then you should be you should be good to go the next time around. All right, so that's it for this episode of StellaCast. Thank you so much for joining me in my culinary ramblings. This one was for the breadheads, so if you are interested in learning more about baking bread, we have an amazing resource on StellaCulinary.com for that. So I would start by listening to our 5-episode podcast series, which you can find by going to StellaCulinary.com/SCS, and that will give you the, you want to start at episode 18 for that. Then we have a massive bread video index, StellaCulinary.com/SB. You can watch all of our bread baking videos there. And then we have our forum, which is filled with breadheads like Dave Mott and Wartface and many others who are there to help you in your quest for amazing bread. Hit me up on Twitter, at Chef Jacob. Check out the forums, and I'll see you guys in the next episode.